Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of Black History Month? While Americans continue to debate whether February commemorations honor or marginalize the contributions of African Americans, humor writer Larry Wilmore jokes that 28 days of trivia hardly makes up for centuries of oppression. Wilmore started in stand-up comedy before focusing his career on writing. But a few years ago, eager to return to performing, Wilmore joined the cast of Comedy Central's highly popular fake news show, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, with the self-created title of Senior Black Correspondent. He has just published a new book called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. Larry, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
It seems that a lot of your work looks not just at what's funny about race, but about the way the races are trying to relate to one another. Can you talk about why that interests you?
That's pretty accurate, I would say. You know, I guess I kind of find that kind of thing interesting from a comic point of view. It's the stuff that just makes me laugh, you know, how we actually digest things more than the actual thing itself. Like, racism is not funny to me, the scourges of it. But the way we interpret what's racist and that kind of thing can make me laugh.
Yeah, and a lot of times you play on the fear that, for example, well-meaning white people have of inadvertently saying something racist or of actually being racist in some latent way that they don't even recognize within themselves.
I'm making a career out of that.
I mean, is it something that you still come up across on a regular basis?
I don't know. You know, I just try to you know, when I see something, I just try to give it my particular spin on it. It's a spin I've had for a long time, you know, and just try to not take anything too seriously is basically my point of view.
To what extent do you think that people of races other than African-American look to Black comedians for sort of guidance on what's acceptable to laugh at now?
Look to Black comedians?
And I have a sort of a follow-up question to this, but do you see that people sort of go there?
You know what? I think people, you know, I hate when people look for permission to laugh at something. You know, I don't really subscribe to that. I always say, if you're making fun of yourself, you know, you're pretty much okay. Just when you're making fun of somebody else, you know, you're taking your chances. So you got to be a little careful with that, you know.
Well,
some people have been able to get away with it. Like, you know, Don Rickles was a master of that. He was great, you know, but he was really good at that, and he was really funny, and he was so outrageous that it was funny, you know.
But then he just got in trouble. Did you hear about this a week or so ago?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah, he made some comment about how the president would be off playing basketball at some point when there was a crisis. And, and apparently the audience present was just really turned off by that.
Oh, was that the Letterman thing? That was a few months ago. But the thing is, Obama does play basketball. So I don't know why he would get in trouble for that. It's not the worst thing that Don Rickles has ever said, by the way, you know. But and plus, he's in his 80s. He can blame it on anything at this point.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. There's a point at which you're no longer responsible for whatever it is you blurt
out. Exactly. I'm
wondering what you think about, Steve Carell's character, Michael Scott, on The Office. They did that thing where he recites Chris Rock material and gets it completely wrong.
Well, I helped to write that episode.
Right, right.
I was Mr. Brown in it. And it was a fun look at that type of sensitive training in the workplace, you know, that sensitivity training.
Yeah,
kind of our take on it.
Mr. Brown was the diversity counselor.
That's right.
Yeah, and in that one, you were completely straight.
Yes.
And that's got to be a strange thing to do in an environment where everybody else around you is acting so ridiculous.
Well, it was really, really tough. In fact, we laughed so much during that, and I have some of the outtakes to it on DVD. I kind of saved it, you know, because we had such a good time. And that was the first show we produced after the pilot of The Office, actually. So at the time, we really didn't know what the response to the show would be or if we'd even be able to make more than 5 episodes, which was how much we were given at that point. So, you know, Greg Daniels, the showrunner, he just decided just to have as much fun as possible and not leave anything on the writer's table, just put it all in the shows.
How does it work around a table for a show like that? Does everybody sort of come and pitch an idea and then you all work together, or is one person really taking the lead on the episode?
Well, the person that takes the lead is Greg Daniels. He's the showrunner. Whoever's the showrunner kind of guides everything. But all the writers, I mean, we all pitch ideas and, you know, contribute to the scripts. And usually one writer writes the actual script after everyone is given their ideas. And then it comes back, and we all pitch more ideas for it and, you know, and kind of shape it to get ready to be filmed and that sort of thing. On The Office, it was the type of show where we would just come up with as many ideas as possible and rewrite them on note cards and just place them on the billboard or whatever on the board. And after a while, there were like hundreds of cards up there. You know? And I remember writing an episode where I just took like three cards and made an episode out of it.
Huh. How competitive is the environment?
How competitive did you say?
Yeah, like when you've got 18 cards up there, are you really, really pulling
for
those?
Well, there's no ownership to the cards, mm-hmm. you know. It's just what's funny. Mm-hmm. There really is no ownership in that sense. The Office was a fun kind of competitiveness. It wasn't that kind of toxic type that you have on some type of shows. But it was the kind of competition where you just want to put the best thing on, you know.
Earlier in your career, you've worked on a lot of sitcoms, we should say. Fresh Prince, Bernie Mac, Sister, Sister, you wrote some for. I'm wondering how it works when you join a show as a writer that's already been in production. Do you have to go back and sort of study old episodes so that you get a sense of things? Or
pretty much. If you've been a fan of it, it makes it a little easier. You know, if shows have been on for a while, you want to make sure you're caught up with where the show is at before you join a show. Many shows I've been on from the beginning, which is kind of a lot more fun for me because you really get to be more inventive and come up with a lot of things, you know. And, of course, I created a couple of shows, and that's a lot of fun because you get to invent everything pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah.
But, they both present their different challenges. So.
You were right there at the beginning with the Bernie Mac show and won an Emmy for
that.
Well,
I created it.
Yeah.
I was more than there at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about, it was really sort of different from even other, I guess we can call them black comedies that have
sure.
been on in the past.
Yeah. I was really going for, I never thought of the show as what somebody would call a typical black show, whatever that is, you know. I always saw it as a show about raising kids. Like when I pitched the show to Bernie, I said, Bernie, the way I see this is kids are terrorists and you don't, you know. And that was the basic theme of the show, you know. And I just held on to that for, that theme rides through every single scene of that show, you know.
And it was something that I guess Fox didn't see the same vision for the show that you did.
No, they really wanted it to be something that it wasn't, you know. And I didn't want to do what it wasn't, you know. I wanted to give kind of a more honest appraisal of that and have characters that seem more real and not real cookie cutter. But I think at the time they were more interested in more of a cookie cutter type of thing. Mm-hmm. They wanted to put it up in front of an audience, you know, wanted to be three camera show and things that I just didn't agree with. So,
do you think that there is a renaissance somewhere out there in the future for the three camera sitcom?
It's possible. You know, I always say a good idea is what guides it, you know. I think if you have something funny that's entertaining, it doesn't matter if it's three camera or single camera. You know, just the execution is what matters of it. I mean, Everybody Loves Raymond, classic sitcom, you know, was done in front of an audience, three camera show. And Seinfeld was kind of a hybrid. Some of it was shot outside. Some of it was done on a regular three camera type set. You know, and then you have The Office, which is all single camera. So to me, it doesn't matter so much. But I think when you have a concept for something, you should kind of stick to that concept, you know, and kind of see it through.
How different is the experience of writing something for another actor as opposed to writing something that you're going to perform yourself?
Very, very different. Sometimes I think it's easier on your psyche to write for someone else because you're in service of their vision, I guess, so to speak. It's your vision, too, but you're trying to make them look good and trying to present them in a certain way. When it's for yourself, it's a little more emotional in terms of, God, I don't know if I'm going to look good doing this.
You know? Can't blame the writer if it doesn't work out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so there's a little bit more psychology involved for writing for yourself. And sometimes it's hard to step out of it and look at yourself for what you really can and can't do. You know, it's easier to look at someone else and look at their pluses and minuses, you know.
Yeah, and in a show like The Office, I know that a lot of the performers on that show are also on the writing staff.
Yeah, Greg wanted that from the beginning. He hired writers who he felt were performers. Mindy Kaling had written a show off Broadway about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, where she played, I forgot which one she played. I think she played Matt Damon. And
she's Kelly Kapoor on The Office.
Yeah, she's mm-hmm. Kelly Kapoor. And B.J. Novak was a stand-up comic and a writer. Paul Lieberstein, who plays Toby, I didn't even know he was a performer. He was on the staff of the Bernie Mac show. I'd hired him as a writer on that show. And on The Office, when he started doing Toby, I was like, Paul, I would have put you on the Bernie Mac show. I didn't know you were this good. He's done some amazing work on that show, you know.
Do you think that writers basically have to sort of have some acting ability in order to be able to write, especially for something where you're putting dialogue on a page?
I don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so. I just think you have to... I think it's good to know about acting, and I think that is a plus, but I don't think you have to know how to act to do that, you know, because writers are tapping into something different than what actors are using for what they do.
And I would have to imagine that it's a great situation for the actors if they're in a lot of contact with the writers, but that's not really typical, is it?
It's not always a good thing, because many times all actors are concerned about are their own lines.
Right, they know? Look good and their character is advancing
exactly.
And all that.
Exactly, and they can't always see the big picture. The writer's thinking of the big picture, you know, what's important for the story, what's important for the scene. Many times the actor's only concerned with how many lines they have or if they look flattering or unflattering, and sometimes that can work against you for the scene, you know.
Is there also a certain amount of angst with not wanting to appear that you're putting yourself in too many scenes as an actor?
Oh, certainly. I mean, writers kind of feel that way probably a little bit more. They're a little self-conscious about putting themselves too much in things, you know. I don't see that as much from actors, though. They don't care.
How do the pieces for The Daily Show come together? Do you come up with a concept and call New York and you talk about it on the phone, or how does that go?
Yeah, that's exactly how it goes, actually. And sometimes it works the other way also, because I live in Los Angeles, and usually it's one or two things. Either someone screws up in the news, and I'll call and say, you know, I got to do something on this, or I'm thinking about something, and I'll call. Or they're thinking about something, and they'll call me. Or they'll just call and say, Larry, when are you going to be back here? And we'll just set a date when I'm going to be there. And then when I get there, we figure something out.
And do you have sort of full use of their production team? Most of your pieces for The Daily Show, you're just there on set, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I do field pieces. Some of my favorite ones were with John Oliver.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, we did a thing where the guy councilman wanted to ban the N-word, and we tortured him. It was so much fun.
And when you're out, those interview pieces, how often are people in on the joke and how often are they completely
clean? They're not really in on the joke. I mean, we're just talking to them, you know, straightforward, and we usually have a topic or something. I mean, the guy wanted to ban the N-word. That was his agenda. Mm-hmm. We were just there to ask him questions about it.
It's astounding sometimes the lack of guile that people seem to have, though, when they appear as interview subjects.
Well, people really want to be on television. That's one thing I realized, you know. That's the great equalizer.
So they sort of know that they might be humiliated and they don't care?
The lure of wanting... Have you ever seen reality TV?
Yeah, I know. Well, I know.
People don't care about humiliation. They care about being on television. You know, that's what they really, really care about.
Well, but it's funny, and people never believe this. Having been in TV and radio for a long time, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. So I have
exactly.
A hard time relating to it.
No, I'm completely on your side. You know? I kind of do it because I like writing jokes and getting laughs and that sort of thing, but I don't do it just to be on television, you know. But a lot of people do. They really want to be on TV.
Larry Wilmore is my guest. He is a writer, and he is the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His new book is called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Larry Wilmore. He is the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and has a new book out called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. One of the things, Larry, that I think is so much fun about the character that you play when you're on The Daily Show is that you sort of vacillate wildly between really embodying every stereotype on, you know, in one segment, and then in the very next, or sometimes in the same one, you will sort of take umbrage at something. I'm wondering if that's the sort of thing that you have to have the right audience in front of you, or else people can't quite follow you within that change.
I think you'd have to get in a different business, I guess. If people didn't laugh, then, of course, it wouldn't be funny. But, I always tell people, like, people say, Larry, do you actually believe that? And I say, you know what? I don't have an opinion. I just take positions. That's where my humor comes from. Because I feel like, who cares about my opinion? It's funnier to take positions and then defend it.
Do you learn things from the way people respond, though, when you do a certain bit?
Well, you always do as a performer. Mm-hmm. You certainly do, you know. Some kinds of things get laughs and some things don't, you know. But that's more of a technical comedy thing more than anything else.
And how much are they...
Like, in other words, I don't have an agenda that I'm trying to get across. You know, I'm just trying to do, you know, clever comedy about something that's topical, you know.
But you have to recognize that you're contributing something to the way people at least think about race and talk about it.
Well, I always feel that's a bonus, mm-hmm. you know. If that happens, that's a bonus. But it's not what I'm setting out to do.
You have a piece in the book, a very funny chapter, wherein you rate angry black churches.
Yes.
And the top contender earns 5 raised black fists.
That's right. Very important. It's like a Zagat's restaurant.
You were raised Catholic, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Was there a point at which you got curious about the black church experience and thought to yourself, well, I have to go check this out?
You know what? I never quite did. I mean, not to a real curious point of view, you know. You know, Catholic, we're just too neurotic. We're really like Jews, except with different holidays.
Yeah, know? I've always thought the two, that there's guilt and...
very, very close. Just mm-hmm. different holidays. That's really the only difference. So, you know, you always have that image of the nun trying to smack you, you know, if you go to a different church or whatever, you know, so...
Did that give you a really different sort of experience growing up black in America than you were sort of supposed to have, according to conventional wisdom, having not attended a traditionally black church?
I think so. I think in many ways I felt like a person commenting on things a lot more, you know. I mean, I certainly had what you would call an authentic black experience in other ways, but I didn't have that black church experience that a lot of blacks have in America, that's for sure.
And your father was a doctor when you were growing up, is that right?
Not growing up. He was a probation officer growing up. My parents divorced when I was about 11, and my mom pretty much raised the 6 of us. But my father went back to school in his 40s and became a doctor.
That's amazing.
At about the time I was starting college.
Mm-hmm. And you have a brother who's also a writer, is that right?
Yeah, Mark. Very funny. He writes for The Simpsons right now, and he used to do stand-up. And he was a performer in Living Color for a while. He used to do Archie Bunker, and... He did Maya Angelou on the show. And stuff.
Oh, yeah. Do you get together and are things particularly funny in your family? Or
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But not funny in a way where people are characters, you know, mm-hmm. is what is funny about my family. They're not in control of their funny. You know, which, you know, a lot of people can relate to that, you know. So my brother and I were always the ones to point it out, you know, so that's where our humor kind of comes from.
And are you particularly close among the 6 kids?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We were always very close, mm-hmm. my brother and I.
Larry Wilmore is my guest. His new book is called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Kenny in Farmers Branch. Hey, Kenny.
Hi, how you doing, Chris?
Great, thank you.
Hey, Larry.
Hey, Kenny, how's it going?
Good. I'm from Chicago.
Great,
and,
that's where my parents
are from. I'm Polish Catholic, and I remember growing up and hearing a lot of Polish jokes.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it was like, we were easy marks.
Right.
Do you think maybe one day that black people will kind of take over that mantle and they'll be the new Polish?
I don't think so, because...
And be accepted at least as much as Polish people, and now Polish is nothing.
Well, I know Polish jokes were really funny for a while, but I guess it just kind of went out of style. You know, I'm not sure what happened. I remember having. Did you ever remember that book? It was the Book of Polish Jokes, and then you turned it over, and it was a Book of Italian Jokes. This was like years ago, you know, and that was like the last strike on that thing. But black people and Polish people completely different because black people were really persecuted in society. They can't really be the focus of a joke of people picking on them because we're just not in that position, you know. How Polish people got in that position is beyond me. You know, maybe it was self-deprecating humor at first. I'm not too sure. So.
Yeah, I wondered about that. If that sort of originated in Europe and then they came here and that was something.
I know. I'm not sure about that. Somebody should really look into that. You know, but somehow they turned it around. You don't really hear it too much.
Do you think that humor makes it easier for people to have hard discussions, or is that sort of an overly simplistic way of thinking about it?
No, I don't. Yeah, you never know. It could. You know, I think it's a good tool to. If you're going to have a discussion about things, but I'll be honest with you, I'm just interested in satire and looking at things from a comic point of view, you know. So that's kind of my focus more than opening up any kind of dialogue, you know.
Do you feel like in some ways the trajectory of your career has put you in a place where people now expect you to only talk about race?
Well, I don't know about that, you know. I mean, I pretty much... you know, because I have different forms, you know, I also write and produce, you know, I can do other things and that sort of thing. But I've kind of embraced this myself because I feel like now is a good time to really kind of explore this whole thing, especially with Obama as president and that kind of thing. So it's more of something that I've wanted to do myself.
You've been working on another, is it a series where you play a black president?
You know, I was developing something for HBO, but I decided to scrap it and go with something else.
How does it work when you decide on a new project? I guess you have to go find somebody who's willing to pay to produce it, and then you have to develop it, and then you get it to a stage, and then it may or may not go somewhere?
It can be like that. I pitched an idea to HBO about a year ago, and they liked it, but after developing it, I wasn't too crazy about it, so I kind of scrapped it. Mm-hmm. And just trying to work on figuring out what I really want to do there. But it depends. Many times you can sell a pilot script, that kind of thing, or just sell an idea and you develop it and write it and produce it and all that kind of stuff.
I've wondered about this a lot. In just about every other line of work, I mean, save brain surgeon or whatever, you can go into the office in a really bad mood and still function pretty well.
Right. Although I don't want a guy doing brain surgery on me in a bad mood.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, we're going to leave them out of there, you know, people who have their finger on the button.
Yeah.
Is it harder, though, to handle a tough day when your job is to be funny?
No, you know what, because you're a professional about it. You know, it's your job. You know, you really do view it like that, you know. So you just get it done and do it. And many times the act of doing it makes you feel better anyway when you can laugh about it. I mean, we have permission to go to work and make jokes, so... You know, many times it does make you feel better.
How is your process different when you're sitting in a room full of writers as opposed to when you are sitting alone with the book or writing a piece that you'll do solo?
It's a lot harder doing it by myself because I'm a classic procrastinator. I even have found ways to procrastinate my procrastinating. It's true. Like, I have certain things I do to procrastinate, and then sometimes I'll procrastinate doing that. It's really insane. So, but when you're with a group, you have to produce. You have to do something, you know, otherwise, you know, you're in a lot of trouble. So.
Do you like to work in an office somewhere, or do you work at home when you're working on something by yourself?
By myself, I work at home mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I fly a lot, so sometimes I'll work on the plane and that kind of thing.
Do you find that being in that, sometimes people talk about being, you know, when they're traveling, they're in this really suspended state of everything, and it's really creative for them.
Sometimes it can be. I mean, when I was in high school and in college, I used to take the bus everywhere, and so I was kind of used to kind of brainstorming around a lot of people and kind of just being creative in that mode because I had no choice. I had to take the bus everywhere. So.
Did you always know that you wanted to write something?
No. In fact, I never thought of myself as a writer. I came to it very reluctantly. I was doing a stand-up comedy, and I needed an act, or I wanted to do stand-up, let's say, and so I had to write jokes in order to have an act. So it just kind of happened on its own.
Do you still do stand-up?
I'm starting to do it again. I just started a couple months ago, and after having about a 12, 13-year hiatus.
And I guess it takes...
Probably longer, maybe 15 years.
It takes a while to build up all the material that you'd use in a set, right?
It does. But at this point, you know, I'm not doing it to, like, back when I really did it, you know, I was trying to have a career with it and do all that. Now I'm a little more relaxed about it. You know, it's just, I'm really writing just what really makes me laugh and without any other pressure on it.
Is there something about that that's really good for your skills?
For my skills?
You know what I'm saying. I mean,
you know, I got some skills. you know, anytime you do it, it's good for that. I guess you get better at it. But, you know, it's kind of like riding a bike doing stand-up. You know, I hadn't done it for years, and it just took about two or three times of doing it to get back in that mode, you know, of feeling like, oh, okay, I can do this.
And does it take a while to get into the sort of late-night mindset that you have to be in? Because suddenly all your energy, I don't know if you're a morning person or a night person, but it has to be really focused on those couple of hours.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because my life was completely different writing. I wasn't hanging out in clubs at 1 in the morning waiting to go on, you know. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, when you're writing on shows, you can be up all night writing scripts, you know. So it can be just as bad in terms of the hours, you know. But no, you know, it's not that tough, really, to be honest with you.
And you've got kids, right?
Yes, I have two.
I'm sorry?
12 and 10.
So they're at an age where they're probably old enough to sort of consume a lot of what you produce.
Yeah, you know, even when they were a lot younger, they knew if Daddy had something on TV and they would laugh at it. I remember my daughter, she had memorized all of the little girl's lines on the Bernie Mac show from the pilot, and she was only a few years old herself, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
She would go, Uncle Bernie, that kind of stuff. And I was like, hey, that's great, Lauren, you know. And now my son loves reciting what I do on The Daily Show, you know. He'll say it back, you know.
Do you ever have to sit down with them and sort of, you know, explain the content of something or make sure that they understand when it's appropriate to bring that out and when it's not?
You know, I always caution them about language and that sort of thing. Or, you know, now that they're getting older, we can talk about politics and that kind of thing. And I took them to the inauguration.
Oh, that must have been great.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted them to experience it. We didn't have a ticket or anything, you know. I ended up getting one in one of the standing sections, but, you know, it was still kind of far away. But I just wanted them for years later to be able to say that they were there, you know, and whatever they get out of it is great.
It's really interesting to think about that generation and how they'll
view...
Yeah,
completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they're growing up in a world where it's a given that a black man is president. It's not an unusual thing, you know. So their world is completely different. You know, in so many different ways, you know.
Do you think, how much of that do you think, you know, for our generation, Generation X, I mean, we've put some of that in place, but I wonder, you know, where that comes from in them.
You know, it's just the evolution of things. Things change. You know, my daughter in kindergarten, one of her best friends had two moms, you know, and it's not a big deal for her generation that that's the case, you know. She just has two moms, you know, that's just the way it is, you know. If that was the case when I was a kid back in the 60s, it would have been scandalous, you know.
Yeah, it is funny. I guess the things that they're exposed to just don't seem odd in the same way that things that we were exposed to would have made our parents crazy.
Right. Of course, we did get a man on the moon when I was a kid, and they haven't done that yet. So,
I guess they're working on getting one back. But Larry Wilmore is my guest. He is the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and has a new book out called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts.
Very good.
If you want to join us, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Is this your first book?
Yes, it is. I thought about doing it a while ago, but I got kind of the nerve up in the summer of 2007 to actually do it. But it was tough because at first I wanted to do just a parody of The Audacity of Hope, you know, and just kind of do like a book of essays. But then I thought, I don't know about that. And then I got the idea to make it this fake collection of material that existed before. You know?
That all the transcripts have somehow been miraculously saved.
Right, right. So as if someone collected my black thoughts over the years. And I thought, oh, that makes me laugh a little better, you know, a little bit more. And it seemed like an easier thing to write for the way my brain works, you know.
The other, I like the whole book, but you also have one chapter where you say, you talk about how black weathermen make you really happy.
Yes.
And then in the next chapter, you write almost the same thing, but from the exact opposite perspective, how black weathermen depress you.
They make me feel sad.
Yeah.
It's the fact that they make me feel happy, which I call the Roker effect. It's the combination of black weather and fat that somehow releases endorphins in my body. Makes me feel happy. But then that feeling of happiness, after a while, actually makes me feel sad. The fact that they make me feel happy in reality, makes me feel bad. That was kind of the point of that, I guess.
I'm wondering if that's an exercise that you go through a lot, where you'll take the same issue, and as you said, you're just trying to put things out there.
Right.
And then you attack it from different, entirely different perspectives.
You know, that is a really good example of that, that I can take one issue, a silly issue like Black Weatherman, and give a very good, valid argument for both sides, using almost the exact same words. I did that kind of as that exercise, to use almost the exact same words, but give a really valid argument for either one, you know. Because you could read either one and agree with it. You know?
That's going to make people crazy who want to find a message in every single thing that you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. People are always asking, well, what do you think? You know, what is your opinion? I go, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what my opinion is. Who cares?
Well, it is interesting working on something like The Daily Show where, yeah. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that it is social commentary, the entire show.
Well, it's I don't know if I agree with that.
No?
I feel that it's more satire of the way news is delivered more than it is a social commentary.
Well, I guess it's, but you still have to.
It was always meant as a parody of news broadcasts. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a show disseminating the way the news is delivered and how it's being delivered and who's delivering it more than anything else.
How do you keep track of everything that's going on? You have to know what's happening in the entertainment world. You have to know what people are writing and producing. You have to know what's going on in the news. Is there a service?
I can't keep up with all of that. You know, I try to read a lot of newspapers and watch the news, but I get so behind on pop culture. I could not tell you what songs are. Like, if I watch the Grammys, I have no idea who anybody is. There's just not enough time in the day, you know. So I'm always, music is the thing that in the last 10 years has really fallen behind for me. When I was single and didn't have anything going on, you know, a struggling artist, I knew everything about what was going on in music, but God, it's so hard.
Yeah, once you start working and then you have kids and then forget it, all you know is their music.
Yeah, exactly. You have to listen to what they listen to, right?
Larry Wilmore is my guest. His new book is called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. We'll be back in just a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and performer Larry Wilmore. He is the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His new book is called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Betsy in Grapevine. Hey, Betsy.
Hey. Just have a quick comment. I don't know if anybody heard this, but there was a show on prior to yours, Fresh Air. And it was about this woman from New York Magazine that's writing a story about the only suspected terrorist who's actually being held in the United States. And he's been confined several years, and apparently they eventually were able to get him a TV. And the deal is he can't watch any news at all. But she found out through his attorneys that his favorite shows are The Daily Show and The Colbert Report.
And he's a terrorist?
Well, suspected, but I guess they're calling him a terrorist, yeah.
Very good. I'll take fans anywhere I can find them.
Well, he calls Jon Stewart the Jew, but he really likes him.
Oh, I love that. He still hates him, but he finds him funny. Right?
Do you have to be careful not to over-rehearse those segments that you do so that they feel really natural? I mean, obviously, you guys are all professionals, but I wonder if there's a point at which there's diminishing returns.
No, we don't have time for that because the show's on every day. I mean, you barely have enough time to get everything written, you know, and we just have pretty much a one run-through with the cameras, and after that, we do another rewrite where John pretty much goes through every line of the show. Like when I'm on the show, I go through it with John line by line, and we go over it, do a lot of cutting, you know, editing it down, that sort of thing. And then when we do it on the air, it pretty much is the first time we're doing that version of it. So.
Does the delay, and it would be impossible to put together sort of a show that reflected everything that happened that particular day.
Right.
Does the delay just make everybody crazy, though?
The delay of...
The fact that you're really responding to most things a day after they have happened as opposed to the same day.
What are you going to do? I mean, I remember being in Hawaii getting USA Today like a day late, and that was very frustrating. I was like, USA yesterday. But there's nothing you can really do about it, and I think people pretty much expect it. And, it's a bit frustrating, but what are you going to do?
And are there just teams of interns and people pulling clips that might make good fodder for things?
They have an unbelievable research team at The Daily Show. And some of the people who work in research there, they're like new savants, you know. Like, they'll say, George Bush said this thing 3 years ago, you know, at this new... It's like, how do you know that, you know? Do you have a life at all? You know, how could you possibly know that? And the writing staff themselves are very, very smart and funny people, you know. And, so it's a really good group over there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak to Frank. Hey, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
Great, hey, thanks.
Great. Larry, I love your work.
Thank you, Frank.
You made a reference with a previous caller to a book, the Polish joke book. When you flip it over, the Italian joke book. I think you and I are probably the only two in the world that had that book.
There was another one, too. I think it was German and something.
There was a black joke book out once upon a time.
Oh, you know, it was German-Irish. German on one side, Irish on the other. That's what it
was. Right. But my question for you, Larry, is how do you think we can attribute the change in how African-Americans are portrayed on television from less satirical to more reality as we move, like, from... The Jeffersons or Good Times back in our day,
right?
The more reality type shows are the more successful African Americans that we're seeing on television now.
Well, everything kind of exists in its time. You know, when Good Times came out, it felt very real to a lot of people because a show like that hadn't quite been done on television. You know, showing these people who lived in this impoverished situation trying to make it. You know, and the Cosby Show was kind of the opposite of that. It had its own kind of verisimilitude, you know, of a wealthy couple, you know, upper middle class and that sort of thing. You know, not every show can do that, I guess, but all you can do is try to do whatever you can, you know. And I think the times kind of, you know, forces out the show sometimes more than the other way around, you know. It's kind of like the marketplace almost makes it happen sometimes.
Can you make a distinction in your mind? Is there any sort of stylistic difference between shows that are... probably written for a general audience that feature mostly black characters as opposed to those that are written specifically for an African-American audience?
I suppose so. You know, you don't find as many of the first anymore. Well, there aren't that many black shows with, shows with primarily a black cast anymore on television, unfortunately. I'd like to see more because... I think the more you have, the more you get the variety of shows that are out there. I mean, at one point you had everything from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which was more the first type of show, you know, more of a broader type show. And then you had something like Martin, you know, which was a little more in the middle of the bullseye for a target audience, I guess you could say. But it was more of a kind of a hip-hop culture type show, too. So it wasn't like necessarily black and white so much as it kind of had a hip-hop kind of feel to it. I guess, and certainly in Living Color was that. I always say in Living Color was the first show to kind of bring in the hip-hop culture to television more than it was a black-white thing, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Is the Chris Rock show Everybody Hates Chris still on the air?
I think so. I think it's on the CW, I think.
Yeah. Have you seen it? Do you like it?
I saw the first couple, and I liked it a lot. I thought it was pretty funny to do a show that takes place, you know, in a certain period of time with that look and everything, and, you know, the premise that this kid just can't win at all. Funny premise. And, of course, Chris Rock, who's one of my favorites, just hearing his voice kind of makes it funny. So, yeah, I did like it.
Yeah, and the great thing about that show that I thought was remarkable is that although the parents are always sort of financially struggling, it's not really about that.
Right, right, right. It's about the kids struggling, really, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, I just, it'd be great if there were more of that, but, you know, what are you going to do?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Dallas, calling from Dallas. Hey.
Hey, thank you. Chris, you do a great job, by the way.
Thank you.
Larry, I just wanted to comment. I know you seem to be so self-effacing almost.
Yeah.
I really wanted to compliment you because I think the type of stuff that you guys are doing, and as you were talking about the Cosby show,
right.
show just a minute ago, it reminds me of some years ago I was riding. I used to live in Philly.
Uh-huh.
I'm riding the subway, and apparently the Cosby show the night before had done a piece on Martin Luther King.
Okay.
And I'm sitting next to two older Caucasian women, and I'm African-American, and they talk about how, yeah, they love the Cosby show, but that little Martin Luther King thing went a little bit over the edge. This was when we were still trying to get MLK Day, I guess.
Right.
But the thing that you do, I think it's make it easier to talk about a lot of issues, and shows that even like Think help us talk about a lot of issues that normally are very difficult to talk
right.
about. And humor really adds a lot of value. At some point, we'll actually get to a point where we can talk about slavery and the value that slavery had, despite the fact that it's a pretty discouraging aspect of it and somewhat demoralizing to a country. But there was a lot of value brought to this country because people worked. And people who survived that had to be something special to keep moving. So anyway, I think you make that a lot easier to talk about, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the nice compliment. You know, slavery is one of those tough issues, you know, because it was such a scourge. And I think it has done damage to both black and white. But also, as you say, because of going through that, I think in the end it can make people stronger. And I think our country, at the end of the day, has done some good things because we did some bad things, you know. So.
Well, I guess the hard thing to talk about with slavery is that it's just so antithetical to what we want to believe we are in this country.
And antithetical to all the fundamental principles of what the country was built on. So, but that's kind of the, you know, the kind of the dichotomy of human nature, you know. We're all try to be one thing while we're really another sometimes, you know.
Do you ever sort of stop and think what makes it so difficult for us to talk about race to people who are of other races? I mean, it's one thing sort of within one's own group. People can usually discuss things, but everybody's yeah. afraid of crossing that line.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I think with the black-white issue, it really is because of the relationship blacks have had in this country. And as bad as slavery was, Jim Crow was just as horrible in many different ways, you know. And so there's a lot of pain associated with it, and that's one of the reasons why it's hard to talk about black-white racism. The other stuff, I think, may be more politically correct type stuff in my mind, you know, if there's no history of interaction, who cares? You know, that's the way I look at it. It's like they're jumping on the slavery train, you know. But, and people can be touchy about things, you know, for whatever reasons. But, you know, like I say, I like to try to look at things from a different perspective and try to at least be self-deprecating about it.
What do you find so far to be funny about Barack Obama?
Funny? He tends to over-explain a little much for my taste. You know, I want him to get to the point a little quicker, you know.
He's pedantic?
Yeah, you know, a little too much explanation. You're like, what did you have for breakfast? For breakfast, I ate on a plate. And, you know, it's like, okay, can you get to what was on the plate? It was a good plate. But we'll see. Hopefully there'll be some more stuff coming out. You know, you can always count on the Democrats to be very funny, though.
Is it difficult on working on something like The Daily Show where I'll just throw this out there.
Sure.
The assumption is that the perspective is much more liberal than conservative. When suddenly liberals are in charge of everything, what do you do?
Well, when The Daily Show started, Bill Clinton was in office. You know, and most of the jokes were directed at him, especially with the Monica Lewinsky scandal and him being impeached. It's just that once Bush got in office, people forgot about that, you know. And there's been 8 years of a Republican administration. 6 of those years, they controlled the House and the Senate. So a lot of the barbs, I think, kind of naturally are going to be pointing in that direction. But, you know, I think with it swinging the other way, I mean, from our point of view on The Daily Show, whoever's in charge, I'm sorry, you're going to be kind of the focus of our comedy. That's just the way it is.
Has there been an unnecessary amount of hand-wringing over how careful you would have to be in treating an African-American president as opposed to any other in terms of comedy?
I think so. I think it's come mainly from white people not wanting to, you know, get in trouble for making fun of a black guy. But you never hear black comics saying, oh, how am I going to make fun of Obama? He's black, you know. It's just, you know, so I think people are getting over that already and will be able to just, you know, talk about a president as a president. So.
How do you decide that something you have worked on, for example, the book or a piece that you're going to perform, is ready?
You know, I never know. It's always a leap of faith, you know. You just take it, I mean, because you have to at some point. It's not like I can test drive it or that kind of thing, you know. You just have to hope that people are going to like it or that it's ready. And you rely on your sense of professionalism. You know, if you've been doing it long enough, you pretty much have a sense or an instinct about something being ready. But many times you can be wrong. You know, you can do a piece and it can fall a little flat and you just kind of miss. But, you know, hopefully you'll be more right than you're wrong.
Do you get better over the years at sort of handling the disappointment when something does flop?
Well, that's always tough. I mean, if something doesn't go well, it's always disappointing, you know. I think with the show like The Daily Show, it's easy to get over because you got to do another one the next day, you know, so it's easy to forget. If you do a film that flops, you know, it takes another couple of years to do another film. So, you know, that living with it probably lasts a little longer. So that's one of the good things about television. There's a faster turnover.
You talked about procrastinating. Do you work better under a deadline than if
Absolutely.
You start? Yeah.
People say, Larry, why do you write? And I say, because I have a deadline. You know, I don't have any romantic notions about writing or that. I do it because I have to turn it in is pretty much how I look at it. But I enjoy doing it, even though it's really tough. You know.
Do you write anything that does not resemble the work that people know?
What do you mean?
Are you working on the Great American Novel somewhere, or is it in the back of your mind?
No, but yeah, I guess maybe I'd have to really think about that. I mean, I wrote for a show called Teen Angel once, which is completely different than anything, I guess.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it came on ABC for a while, and I was a consulting producer on it while I was developing another show. But, yeah, I get all kinds of ideas. I wanted to develop a movie about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in the early 1900s. Which was a drama, not a comedy at all, just because I was interested in that. And I'm very much a bit of a history buff. I like some things like the Lincoln assassination, that kind of stuff, that have nothing to do with what I'm doing now. So.
Have you done dramatic acting as well?
No, I haven't done dramatic acting. I don't think I'm quite good enough to pull off some really good dramatic acting. I could probably do little doses here and there, but... I don't think that's really my thing. I think I'm better at doing ironic type of stuff, you know.
Well, it seems to be working great for you now. Larry Wilmore is currently known as the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His new book is called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts. Larry, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. It's been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.